more twists and turns in Jacksonville's mayor and sheriff races. Governor Scott continues his standoff with the White House and an extraordinary opening round at the 2015 Players Championship. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now never miss a show. You can also catch the daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we've got all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable and a special Q&A with City Councilman Bill Bishop. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how the First Coast is helping the poorest of the poor in Haiti. Plus, we'll speak with the cast of Stage Aurora's Steel Magnolias. All of that ahead. But first is Friday, and here today we welcome our weekly roundtable, Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner, sitting in today. Hi, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
A.G. Gankarski of Folio Weekly in Florida Politics.
Good morning.
And Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
Guys, always great to see you. Lots of news to discuss, but first we want to touch on that legal opinion released Wednesday from the city's Office of General Counsel. Signs on the exterior of Veterans Memorial Arena advertising the Hunt, Green & James law firm violate the city's charter, and at least two of the signs violate state law. That's according to the opinion. Jacksonville City Councilman Bill Bishop introduced legislation earlier this year involving this, and he joins us now in studio with his thoughts. Councilman Bishop, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And your reaction to the ruling from the Office of General Counsel?
It was fantastic. Couldn't have been better.
And tell us a little bit about the legislation you filed in January that led to this effusive praise.
Well, the whole thing goes back to November when I first drove down the expressway coming into town, and I saw these picture of three guys up there, and I'm thinking, what act is coming this weekend? And the closer I got, I realized that they weren't act. It was an advertisement. And where the heck did that come from? And I started asking a lot of questions, and I found out that it was a sponsorship deal that SMG had sold. And I immediately got a meeting with SMG and the sports entertainment people, Dave Harrell, and said, guys, what's going on here? This isn't right. And anyway, next thing led to what? And I said, I want those things down. They're not supposed to be there. And he said, give us some time. Let us work on it. Well, nothing happened. And I said, well, I'm not going to wait forever. And after the first of the year, nothing was going anywhere. So I filed legislation to make sure that that never happened again. And that started the big process. And then I also asked Jason Gabriel, general counsel, give me a binding legal opinion. Are those legal signs? And that kind of just started the whole thing off.
And so there'll be a hearing Tuesday, a public hearing on this, and you're hoping for an approval process that I guess would restrict future signage?
Yeah, the bill has gone through a couple of iterations at this point, and I think where we're going to bring it in for a landing is that the ordinance will be changed to keep the arena in the sports overlay because it's a sports facility, it's an entertainment facility, but to make any signage restrictions match those downtown under the downtown overlay, which then also provides for DDRB approval for anything that gets done on the arena.
Tim Gibbons.
Why exactly? I've kind of struggled to understand exactly what the problem is here, considering we have, you know, the huge scoreboards that you go driving down the highway and are, you know, almost blinding in their brightness. We have, you know, Everbank, you know, great local company plastered everywhere over that facility. Why exactly is this such a problem when, you know, it's basically what happens in sports? You have the Tax Slayer Bowl. You have, you know, sponsorship of everything, you know, every ball that's kicked and thrown and caught is sponsored.
Well, the arena is not the football stadium. The football stadium is, in, at least in my opinion anyway, is a different sort of animal. It's the kind of events that happen there are not the same thing that happen in the arena. Architecturally, the arena is a very fine design. It's a very good piece of architecture, and it's a civic monument. And if we're going to start sticking billboards all over that, where does it stop? Let's stick them on the city hall. Let's put lawyer ads on the courthouse. I mean, at what point do we stop this nonsense and uglify our city? And I don't know whether that's a real word or not, but I like it.
All right, I think you're giving people ideas at this point. To,
Let's talk for a minute about the mayoral runoff election in less than 2 weeks. You came out the other day and endorsed incumbent Mayor Alvin Brown after earlier saying you would stay neutral. What would you say to critics of that decision? They think you're angling perhaps for a job in the administration.
Well, I get a kick out of that. What I said at the time was I'm not going to endorse anybody at this time, and I'm running in 2019. And I said to people, do your homework, ask questions, talk to people, find out what you think. And I said, at some point, I said, I now have to decide who I'm going to vote for. And so after thinking about a lot of stuff, talking to both of them, and just seeing the lay of the land, I decided that Mayor Brown was in the best interest of the city for the next 4 years.
Well, as you know, Lenny Curry made some specific allegations with, you know, dates and all of that, that there was a conversation. You know, he seems to argue that you're fishing for a quid pro quo for his endorse him. Is that something that happened? I mean, how did those conversations go with Curry between your non-endorsement and your endorsement of Alvin Brown?
Lenny can say anything he wants. He's going to say anything he wants. There was no quid pro quo. There isn't anything like that at all. I guess you can ask Lenny how many jobs he's promised to people for people working on his campaign. I mean, this is politics. It's just what it is. And he's going to say what he wants because he didn't get an endorsement, I suppose. That's the only thing I could think of.
My simple question is, Bill, what makes you like the current mayor versus his opponent?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, he now has 4 years of experience. Lenny has none. There's a number of big ticket issues that are still there. And I think primarily, even though the mayor and I did not agree on a lot of how he handled pension reform, the process and a number of pieces of the agreements that he proposed, he has, in fact, done more than anybody in the last, I don't know how many years, to get us somewhere. And most of what was in his proposal was good stuff for the city. And we've still got to get there. And I think that rather than start all over again, I want to see this thing brought in for landing. And I think he and his team are the best ones to do that.
And will you be working with the mayor to try to improve some of the things that didn't work so well the first 4 years between the council and his operation?
If I can, absolutely. I mean, I'm here now for less than 2 months left. I'm out of here at the end of June. Mm-hmm. I don't expect anything really to happen before now and then, because you got an election in 2 weeks and then you got a transition period. And so most of what's going to happen is going to happen after that. But I just think that that's the best way for
All
us
right.
to go.
City Councilman Bill Bishop, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We appreciate it. And as we discuss the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, the number to join us is 549-2937. And a lot happened this week in the city's mayor's race. Endorsements on both sides. AG Gankarski, let's talk about both events this week with Mayor Brown and Lenny Curry, both touting bipartisan endorsements.
Yeah, they did this yesterday. You know, Mayor Brown started it off at 11:30 in the morning with Alberta Hips, former council president, Matt Carlucci, who's been instrumental in the pension deal he formally endorsed. Eric Smith actually did an endorsement bomb. He wasn't advertised in the event, but he showed up, got behind the council people, and spoke anyway. The first endorsement bomb I've seen this campaign. Then Curry comes back with Johnny Gaffney, which is an interesting get, because Gaffney is the first prominent Democrat to endorse him, first prominent African American politician to endorse him. It's a big deal. And the conversation at the endorsement event went to urban blight, whether or not Alvin Brown's done enough for Gaffney's district. Gaffney seems to think no. The HRO came up also, and Gaffney's flip on it. Saying that he wasn't pressured in 2012, and then, yesterday he said he was pressured. So, the Gaffney endorsement event became interesting for reasons other than the endorsement.
Fred Matthews.
Well, it's a nice way to roll up to Friday. we endorsed the death. The TU endorsed. Everybody endorsed this week. The someone that I was looking for Mr. Curry to get was from the other district, not from District 7, but
Eden East Lee.
I'm not going to say that, but thank you for saying it. But anyway, a get is a get, and it's a nice forum. Finally, something he can put out there. It's just that he should have something a little stronger than this. But hey, you get what you can get. Thankfully, I think we may have only one endorsement left out there to get for everybody, and then we can get on to the ultimate poll a week and a half from now.
Well, this ends at some point, right? I mean, what I find interesting, the Mayor Alvin Brown's endorsements, when you look at someone like Carlucci, who is a known supporter, I'm always curious about what the actual impact is of him standing up and saying, I'm endorsing you. Well, yeah, okay, we knew that, sort of thing. On the other hand, voters who don't pay as rabid attention. Maybe they don't know that. Maybe that does help them in some way.
There was kind of a wax museum quality to the Brown endorsements because all these politicians from the 20th century emerging to endorse Alvin Brown. And, you know, Curry countermessaged that with the Peyton and Delaney event yesterday at his Avondale campaign headquarters opening. Yeah. So you're seeing a gap in these endorsements between people who were legislators endorsing Brown and the executive CEO types like mayors, sheriffs, whatever, who are endorsing Curry. So, you know, the messaging there is a little bit different. The language of the endorsement is different. And the Curry side is making the leadership claim explicitly in a way that the Brown endorsers are having to do implicitly because they haven't led in that way.
Well, do you think the Gaffney endorsement takes the wind out of the Brown campaign's, you know, war bipartisan thing, or is it not enough to do that?
There's a counter messaging there happening already. It's pretty aggressive. Warren Jones came out last night with a statement. I'm sure the Brown campaign is going to have an energetic response to undermine the Gaffney endorsement.
And also today, Mayor Brown will appear with Tom Joyner at a big rally this weekend. Lenny Curry has a lot of events planned. Mm-hmm. There were also two big debates this week. Let's talk about those for a minute. Televised debates with the sheriff's candidates and the mayoral candidates. In both, the gloves came off. Dan Scanlon.
Well, I noticed literally a lot of finger pointing, especially in the sheriff's office campaign. And I also noticed a lot of people saying, certain candidates saying, I am doing the job or I did the job pretty darn close and I've got the experience and you don't, especially the final closing comment of Williams, which was basically, I've managed people you haven't.
Though, I mean, it was a testament to how close the races are. And how much, how close they've become. The fact that they both knew, both sides, and Jefferson's side, he's not taking any chances. Now he knows he had to come out swinging against Williams, which is, again, sort of the first time we've seen this kind of the level of vitriol that was there. I mean, there were, and the fact that both of them were putting their dirty laundry on the line, mortgages and judgment decrees
and suspensions,
all of this on the line that quite frankly, nobody in the public really knew about and really cared about. But it goes to character, I guess, is what they want to do. But it was an indication of how close the races are.
There's something I find fascinating about that. And I know, Melissa and AG, you're both really involved in covering this sort of stuff. But as someone who is involved but not quite to that depth, watching some of this and trying to figure out how the thinking is going of you know, how much of it is, holy crap, you know, we really need to make up ground here sort of thing. And it really is a lot of elbow flinging, a lot of pushing and shoving in both of the races, which makes me think both candidates are nervous.
And give us a call with your thoughts on the city's mayor and sheriff's races at 549-2937. Also making headlines this week, Florida Governor Rick Scott continues his standoff with the Obama administration. The governor has filed a lawsuit in federal court alleging the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is trying to coerce Florida into expanding Medicaid. Give us a call with your thoughts about that. The legislative session, Fred, melted down 3 days early over this standoff. Now the House and Senate have to go back to Tallahassee in June to try to pass a budget and figure out if they can possibly come to agreement on this.
Imagine the spectacle again. Here we are in a state who wants to have states' rights, wants to spend their money their way, but they want to call to the federal government to give them money to spend their way. I mean, we should have all been a fly on the wall in that conference that the governor had with HHS Secretary Burwell, pleading for money that he from a government that he decries and has beat up the president for hither and yon for the last 4 years, and you're going to go up there and ask for money?
I mean, case law establishes a precedent. You know, the federal needs always take primacy over the state needs. That goes back centuries. And this is really the thing. The feds are saying that we're not meeting their guidelines for disbursement. And, you know, Rick Scott can posture. He can go to Washington, you know, be a political issue. But, you know, at the end of it, we're going to have to conform to those guidelines or not get the money. It was like that with the highways in the 80s, where some states were wanting to adjust their speed limits, not having them in some places, and the federal government withheld highway funds. It's the same thing, except writ much larger with much bigger consequences.
Can Rick Scott possibly win in this showdown against the feds? Dan Scanlon.
I don't know. I had a conversation this morning with a nurse at one of the local hospitals, and indeed the concern about what happens if this all shuts down, and what happens at this not UF health facility and what happens in their ER, what happens with their staffing, what happens if you break a finger and have to sit there and wait because there is a more serious trauma case being handled that wouldn't have been because the Trauma One facility is shut down. Neither side can win on this. The people will lose.
Yeah, the CEO of U of Health, several times, Tim, has said, if this doesn't get resolved, we will close our doors. There will be no more Trauma One. There will be no more place for indigent care anywhere in Jacksonville.
Healthcare executives are just, you know, petrified of this. There's an interesting take that in some ways the healthcare industry overplayed its hand in trying to force Scott to do what, you know, to make a decision and support Medicaid expansion. But however this plays out, they need the money, and without the money, they can't keep operating. And it's a very serious issue for them.
But it's just a responsible issue, and it's based on pure politics. These guys in the legislature and the governor, I mean, they want to play the game of hating Obamacare so much, in which to the extent that they're willing to put their own citizens in jeopardy. Now, you know, they can argue that Medicaid isn't a big deal because it only applies to poor people, but it goes back to the same argument that the Republican Party has, and that is that they don't care about folks below a certain income level. And this keeps going to that same argument. It is inexcusable that you would do this. It's just inexcusable.
It is an interesting partisan issue from the standpoint that if you have the governor saying, we don't want federal money, we're a state, we're going to stand on our own, and we're not going to take federal money, okay, that's a coherent position. But basically saying, we want the feds to pay, but we don't want poor people to get insurance. That really what it boils down to isn't saying we don't want federal money, we just don't want an insurance expansion.
Well, here's the thing. I'm going to offer some good news here, as I always do. I talked to the UF Health.
Your ray of sunshine.
Always. I talked to UF Health CEO the other day. He said they had enough cash to go, you know, 45 days if the budget doesn't work. He says that this kind of gamesmanship happens every year. And, you know, he's right in that. It's heightened because it's an election season. I think going forward after this particular budget's finally approved, there needs to be more dialogue between the mayors of the major cities and Tallahassee on, you know, how to get a workable solution that is liberated from political rhetoric.
You know, the Jacksonville Civic Council, this group of really powerful CEOs in the city, they've been looking at this issue for many months and have even internally discussed whether it would be possible to set up an independent taxing district in Duval County to fund UF Health. That's the setup in Miami-Dade and in Tampa for those public hospitals. That's a heavy lift, though, and not sure if that will be formally proposed. Dan?
Well, we talked about this when I was here a month ago, and it's scary that it's only gotten worse since then. And, of course, it was also one of the questions and comments made during the mayor's debate this week, Curry stating that there's federal funds out there that are being withheld. We can go for it, and he's going to go to Washington and fight for it. And then the mayor stating that if we lose the money, there's 5,500 jobs on the line here. So he also says he's going to go and fight, and he's working with the governor and Congress.
John Delaney actually had a line yesterday at the Curry event saying that he's done more for UF Health in the last 6 months than the mayor has. In terms of advocating, in terms of press conferences, in terms of, you know, bringing attention to the issue to Tallahassee, he's saying that the mayor is a late adopter of real concern on it. So it's really something where, you know, knowing that this is going to happen every year for the foreseeable future, city governments, you know, need to get out in front of this issue and not leave themselves open to criticism from former office holders.
Let's go to your calls as we discuss the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, whether it comes to the mayor and sheriff's races, the standoff in Florida over health care. What's on your mind? 549-2937. Chuck at the Beaches. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. I heard y'all mention the term Obamacare. I wanted to mention something. I heard that 16 million people signed up for Obamacare. So you figure if there's 16 million people signed up for Obamacare, and that's two parents, that's another 32 million people. And then they got brothers and sisters. So you figure there's 50 million people that would not be happy if something bad happened to Obamacare. And if only 25 million of those people voted, that would be a real problem for the Republican Party.
Chuck, thanks for the call. And you're right, there have been robust signups, especially here in Florida, under the Affordable Care Act. Tim Gibbons, lots of people signing up for insurance. At the same time, the Republicans in the Florida House are going back to constituents in their let's face it, gerrymandered districts where their constituents are saying, look, we don't like this. We don't want you to vote for expanding Medicaid. These representatives will tell you, I'm responding to the wishes of my constituents in my district.
Well, part of the issue, as the caller said, you know, if all of those people who signed up for Obamacare voted, the GOP would be in trouble, except for the fact that some of those people who've signed up are opposed to Obamacare. They love the expansion of Medicare benefit or Medicaid benefits. They love this new government program that's helping them get insurance. They hate Obamacare. And you end up with people who, you know, eventually they're going to, there's a cognitive dissonance there of this thing that you hate is the thing that you love, but there are people benefiting from it who are opposed to it.
Fred.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, it, you found that out in, what, Kentucky? And they had to rename it something else. They called it anything but that. And that's what we are. I mean,
not Obamacare, I think, is what they called it.
I think,
Kentucky for healthcare.
I think even our Senator Rubio has a piece of this action, too, as I recall. I mean, for his healthcare plan. So it's you're not going to get all those people to vote against their party because they're taking the health care plan. I mean, you know, who knows what plan you're taking when you go into the voting booth, right?
Dan.
All I can say is in my family, there's been instances where we have needed what has turned into Obamacare, and it has worked, and I still have money in my pocket. So somewhere it's working, at least on the level it's supposed to.
Well, that's why it's not being talked about anymore in Congress, and we won't get another vote anytime soon to repeal it anytime soon in the dominated houses of Congress now in Washington.
549-2937, Alita in Springfield. Alita, good morning. Hey, Alita, go ahead and turn down your radio.
Okay, no problem. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of the things that that we don't hear about from Jacksonville particularly or in Florida is from the people's perspective. When I say a people's movement, a working class, a low income, we are doing something different since the Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Nurse Alexander cases. Some of the things are dealing with bringing in the U.S. social forum. So we're having people movements, assemblies, because the people, again, that you already said, that are affected, but you do not hear from them. There is no platform. It's those that need this. There is more working class than middle class in the city. There are mothers with children. And those, the people movement assembly is a process that we're going to be bringing to Jacksonville, not just for this medical thing, not just for Obamacare because it's needed, but also for the transportation issues. People have been very disgruntled with the transportation issue in the city. It doesn't work for the people, but it works, again, just like with Governor Scott, for those that are making the money from it, that are profiting. So we hope that we can work with WJCT, just like we've had to in the past, to get the word out that there's got to be another voice rather than just those that are making these decisions. One of myself, who's worked with Obama in the past, that's worked for the human, the HHSF, the National Institute of Health, is that I find it very discouraging that we still don't hear from the people in the communities that are more impacted. So please look out for our People's Movement Assembly coming up in May 23rd. We'll also have one in Springfield. We'll also have several throughout the city in different communities to get the people to see that their voices are important, but that it comes our way, comes out in a way that we can bring this and change what's happening through the what we call the People's Movement Assembly and the U.S. Social Forum, which came out because the United States knowing and feeling that we are human, and people have to be human. That means they have to be heard.
All right.
And have a power.
Alita, thank you. Yeah, thanks for the call. That's Alita in Springfield.
It is remarkable that she said all of that without taking a breath.
But clearly reflecting the strong, the intensity of feeling around this issue.
This is the issue, though. I mean, you know, having people's forums and, you know, with long names is great, and, you know, community engagement's wonderful. But in reality, you've got to maneuver to politicians. You've got to get, you know, somebody like Alvin Brown on board. You've got to get some of the Democrats on council on board. You've got to get that dialogue happening on that level, because on the city level right now, you've got a JTA CEO who's making, what, $300,000?
Yeah.
And all you hear is complaints from people on the north side, northwest side, people who actually need these services more than people on the south side, that the buses aren't working right, that they aren't conducive to transporting the elderly to where they need to go. And, you know, these are real issues. And, you know, this is really a thing. When you've got a significant part of the city that doesn't have effective political representation, you know, in terms of getting infrastructure fixed, in terms of making it where it's not 1955 in these areas anymore, in terms of roads, in terms of buses, in terms of power lines, sewage, and on and on.
All right, let's go now to Sue on the west side. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Nice to be here. My brother has a medical condition that makes him unable to have a regular full-time job, and so he's part of the working poor that would benefit from Medicaid expansion. Just this year, he had some serious medical things come up that his doctors, because he's not insured, his doctor said, you know, we need you to have these things done. And he just said, I just flat out, I cannot do it because I don't have the money to do it and I would be bankrupt.
Yeah.
And he's working as much as he can, and getting on disability takes years because you always get turned down the first time. Then you have to appeal. You've got to have representation. And then it takes a really, really long time. And there's more than just my brother in that situation.
Thanks,
and
Sue.
And those are the people that are not benefiting from this not being expanded.
Thank you, Sue. Joe in Mandarin. Go ahead, Joe. Okay, we lost Joe. But Tim Gibbons, before we move on, your thoughts.
There's an interesting trying to get the two points of the healthcare and the public transportation, which are not topics necessarily that often are joined together. But this idea of the haves and have-nots and how they get represented. Not Ford at JTA is actually considered to be doing a very good job. But, you know, a lot of it is those people on the south side that you're talking about, not the neighborhoods that might need even more of a lifting, because they're just not represented.
I think the people that
the caller was talking about fall in the same sort of pot.
Right. I think AG made a valid analogy in that there's an underclass and a working class in this society that feels that they're being squeezed, that they can't get basic services, that they have no opportunity to rise. You see both parties trying to reflect this for 2016. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton keeps pounding on the theme of income inequality. We now have a socialist on the Democratic side running for president, Bernie Sanders. On the right, Jeb Bush, Fred, his pack is called Right to Rise.
Yes, yes.
You know, so this is clearly going to be an issue in the presidential race.
Yeah. But folks have got to be able to, they've got to vote. You have the ability to vote. You can have an organization all day long. You can meet all week long. But when the rubber meets the road, you've got to make a decision as to which one of these politicians you're going to vote for. You're going to get your people out to vote for, to get them in office, to listen to you. It all came together this last week in Baltimore, because guess what? The mayor, the state attorney, the police chief, the attorney general, and the president, all of them got in place because somebody voted for them, and Baltimore saw that, and it made a difference in the decision that was made there this week.
You know, the woman who would be mayor, Audrey Moran, who ran for mayor at One Jack's dinner last week, the first thing out of her mouth was to urge everybody to vote, and more to vote in a week and a half, 2 weeks,
exactly,
than did at the primary. And she stated some pretty serious numbers, because she basically said, don't complain if you don't vote. Learn more about the candidates. Bill Bishop said the same thing this morning, yeah, chatting with us. Learn who you want. Work and learn about it. So, interesting point she made.
The reality is this, though, these campaigns, I mean, both of them are $3 million campaigns. You got Shad Khan dumping in $100,000 a month. You got the Rummels and the Petways and other people on the other side dumping in serious money. Those are the people the candidates are listening to. You know, we can say they're going to listen to the progressive movement, but the progressive movement, reality, is talking to a subset of people. 5 to 7% of people respond to those tropes. Other people responding to quality of life issues that the messaging operations are putting forth.
And speaking of a subset of people, the best golfers in the world out at Sawgrass for one of the most...
That was a great segue.
I used to work in TV news. This is what we did.
Segue.
One of the most extraordinary opening rounds at the Players' Championship Thursday. 59 players leading or within 4 shots of the lead at one point. Guys, did you watch any of the action?
I'm trying.
You're trying.
But it is great theater. And again, it's one of the great things about being on the First Coast. This time of year, from May through June, the middle of June, it's event after event, and the players is no different. I'm sorry, folks. Tiger's not going to make the weekend cut.
Yeah.
But these new guys, Spieth, and I mean, they are just
McElroy.
Fantastic. McElroy, they are great players, and man, they deserve to be seen.
I'm not a huge golf fan. What I find interesting about the players is what it means for the area, as you said. The idea that we have all of these people coming and viewing the city, hopefully, in a light of we have events like this.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
And if the weather holds up, you're going to keep seeing scores like this because mm-hmm. it's perfect golfing weather. The ball travels well, not much wind, sun.
And, you know, you don't have to like golf, and I don't really care for golf much, but from what I'm hearing, it is an absolute joy to hang out there, to dine, to wine, to wander, to talk.
Oh, yeah.
It is a wonderful venue, and indeed, for weeks ahead, we were hearing, make this your week away from the office business location. Do business at TPC.
The expansion of the vendors, the local mm-hmm. local food merchants has, in particular has been expanded.
But local food merchants,
The
yes.
players in the past couple of years has very much ramped up its sponsorship and involvement of local and national businesses.
It's a big Florida event. And finally, our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week across the state. Nothing from the Players' Championship yet. There is never a shortage of material, though. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Well, only in Florida does literally having sex on the beach land you in jail. And worse. Now, many of us have ordered that sex on the beach cocktail when we're out and about, but it turns out the real thing can get you a lengthy prison sentence. A Manatee County jury Monday found 20-year-old Elisa Alvarez and 40-year-old Jose Caballero guilty.
Kind of an age difference there.
Yeah. Guilty of lewd and lascivious exhibition. They face up to 15 years behind bars and have to register as sex offenders.
I want to go on the record of saying I think that's too long of a sentence. Also, he just got out of prison.
Yeah.
Which I think puts some context there.
Yeah. Only in Florida does the guy trying to rob your house actually end up nabbing the real criminals. Identity thieves. Police in Lauderhill were tipped off when a man they arrested confessed to breaking into a home, but he said that there were fake credit cards being manufactured there. Detectives investigated and found a trove of evidence of a massive identity theft and credit card fraud operation.
I think this is a Rockford Files episode.
Yeah.
Dan.
I have one, and I wrote it up yesterday.
Okay, just one second.
All right.
Finally, only in Florida do grandparents graduate college with honors in the same class as their grandkids. Aww. 80-year-old Rosa Salgado walked with cap and gown Saturday with her class from Miami-Dade College's Wolfson campus. She fulfilled a lifelong dream and graduated with two of her grandchildren, David and Mauricio Salgado. Salgado carried her books to class in a rolling backpack. Teachers say she was an inspiration to the entire student body, telling reporters, learning is wonderful.
That's a TV movie right there.
Isn't that great? And do it quick.
Only in Florida does a man point a gun at a Palatka cop and then laugh when he gets a gun pointed back at him and go, it's a fake, a BB gun. How dumb can you be?
Well, Florida, so yeah. And then thanks to our media panel, Tim Gibbons, Fred Matthews, Dan Scanlon, and A.G. Gankarski. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Later in the hour, the cast of Stage Aurora's Steel Magnolias, but up next, helping the poorest of the poor in Haiti. Stay with us.
New name, new look, great information. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Good for You is a day of celebrating women's health planned just for you. Great speakers, great food, health screenings, and so much more. Hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to WJCT/goodforyou. Makes a perfect Mother's Day gift. This summer, WJCT will introduce several new programs to our weekend schedule. We want your help deciding which new shows come to the First Coast. Starting May 10th, tune in Sundays at 1 o'clock for a special preview of The Moth Radio Hour, Snap Judgment, Wits, and Studio 360. Help us decide what you hear on 89.9.
Get more information at wjct.org/weekends.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4, and it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Jacksonville has distinct neighborhoods with unique issues and priorities, including growth, crime, traffic, and investment. Find out where the candidates stand. WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present a debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry. Listen to Face, Brown versus Curry, Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT FM.
Welcome back. Well, next weekend marks an important opportunity to get involved in ongoing efforts here on the First Coast to lift up the poorest of the poor in Haiti. It's all being done through the microfinance program Fonkaze. And here with a preview, we welcome Jacksonville attorney and local activist on Haiti, Michael Fisher. Good morning.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for having us.
And on the phone from Haiti, Stephen Worlam. He is with CLM, Chemin La Vie Mio, which stands for Pathway Out of Poverty. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you with us on the line from Haiti. We'll get Stephen to talk about CLM in a minute, but first, Michael Fisher. Stephen will be at this dinner and concert at Riverside Presbyterian Church next Saturday, an important learning opportunity, right?
Yes, at 6 o'clock, and Steve will give us a presentation about the CLM program, the most effective program I know of in Haiti for lifting people out of poverty.
Stephen, tell us about CLM.
Yeah. CLM is a program. We started it in about 2005, 2006. We started realizing that we weren't reaching the poorest of the poor. We're a microfinance institution. We have very successful credit programs, but it turns out there are people that are much too poor for credit. So we looked around the world to see if we could find a better approach that would address their needs, and we did. We found one that had been developed in Bangladesh, and we adapted it for Haiti. So the idea behind the approach is simple. We say that you teach someone to fish, you give someone a fish to eat for a day, you teach them to fish to eat for a lifetime, but it's not quite true, because people that don't have access to the tools, the fishing poles, the nets, people who don't have the health that allows them to go out and fish, they won't succeed. So our approach is that we train people to fish, we train people to earn income that they need to live, but we also give them the tools that they'll need to develop their income. So it's a comprehensive approach. We help them with health issues. We help them build small businesses, and it's very effective. 96% of the people that go through this program graduate and are living better lives. Two-thirds are living better lives, continuing to improve even 4 years later. So it's a proven approach, and we've just shown we can eliminate extreme poverty, and we just have to decide to do it.
And, Michael, it's amazing what small amounts of money here in our first world nation can really make a huge difference in a third world country like Haiti.
Yes. Haiti is supported 20% by people of Haitian descent who are sending money back. But that's just a portion of what we need to do for Haiti. You know, some of the statistics are really astounding. We're talking about inequality. That's a big factor today. But when we talk about inequality, in the United States, we have a safety net that averages about $20,000 a year per citizen. In Haiti, people only make $1,000 or less. They're on $2 a day. We've got 5 million Haitians that are under this $2 a day limitation. It's the bottom of the barrel. So if we're looking at places that are inequality, it certainly is very dramatic. And another statistic, only about 5% of our charitable giving goes internationally. the rest we keep at home. My wife always asked me, don't we have enough problems in Jacksonville? And I said, yes, but they're nothing compared with a homeless person in Jacksonville with somebody in Haiti.
We got a call about Haiti and Francais and Pathway Out of Poverty. Danny in Middleburg. Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, back in the 50s, there was more structure in the labor system. There used to be divisions of labor. Now it's just management of labor. And there's no ladder to climb for the lower class. In other words, you know, back, I'm a blue-collar worker, come out of the union. And back in the union, you had four different systems. You had laborers, you had apprentice, you had journeyman, you had foreman, and then you had the owners. Now it's just owners and labor. There's no divisions for people to grow, to gain more money. You know, labor is just across the board at low income, and then the high income makes all the money instead of being divisioned out and, you know, kind of done right in my world. And I'll take your comments. Thank you.
All right, Danny, thanks for the call. Stephen Worland, you'll be presenting Saturday night about Pathway Out of Poverty, and you really want people here in Jacksonville to come out and learn more about this, right?
Yeah, we have a very successful program. We feel that we have evidence that shows we can really help people change their own lives. We don't change their lives for them. They change their own lives. And I think people that hear about it will be excited about it.
Let me add to that, Steve. We have in Jacksonville, we're trying to show we're an international community, that we think out of the box. I know that's been a big issue with the port and with other issues we have in Jacksonville. Well, this program that we're going to present, we have a matching grant up to $25,000 specific to this program, the CLM program. So it's an opportunity for people not only to hear about it, but to also contribute, and if they're interested. Only two things we're asking for people to come to this dinner at Riverside Presbyterian Church and the concert after that is, number one, that they RSVP, and we've got a telephone number. We can have them RSVP, which is 355-4585. They can also go on and understand a little bit more about it at rpcjacks.org. That's the Riverside Presbyterian Church website, as well as they have a Facebook page.
Yeah.
Finally, one other thing, Melissa, is that we're giving for the third year, we're giving the criteria for the most outstanding or an outstanding student of Haitian American background from our First Coast area, to make sure that the Haitian population here in Jacksonville is included in everything we're doing.
Very good. And again, that is next Saturday night, May 16th, at Riverside Presbyterian Church, a free dinner, concert, and presentation. Thank you so much, Michael Fisher and Stephen Worland with CLM, for this very important preview. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And we're back in a moment with Stage Aurora's Steel Magnolias.
Relax around the clock with the music of your life. Playing great music from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald to James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and more. Relax Radio, WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Never know how much I love you.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
The Dinosaur Train is rolling into Orange Park. Thrasher Horn Center and WJCT present Jim Henson's Dinosaur Train Live, Buddy's Big Adventure, on Tuesday, May 12 at 6 p.m. See the beloved stars of the hit PBS series come to life on stage in your hometown for the first time. Join Buddy, Tiny, King, Don, and their family and friends in this fun-filled, interactive musical trip back in time. Tickets are on sale now at 904-276-6815 or thcenter.org.
Join us weeknights at 7 for music. From symphonies to the latest indie music, you'll hear it all weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
Deep below sea, darling, on deep, deep blue sea.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, it's the classic tale of six Southern women who gossip, laugh, and harangue each other through the best and worst of times. Steel Magnolias is hilarious and touching all at the same time, with six strong female leads. Because after all, laughter through tears is everyone's favorite emotion. Jacksonville's Stage Aurora is doing the Broadway hit this weekend only. Here with a preview, director Chantel Bennett Robinson, and in the role of Truvy, Effie Durbin. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with you, Chantel. People who've seen the film might not realize Steel Magnolias was a play first.
Yes, from the beginning it was a play. And I believe actually the play happened a couple of years before it actually came out into a movie where you saw the full version outside of just the six ladies.
Exactly. And Effie, you play Truvy, the beauty shop owner in this production. People who've seen the movie might remember Dolly Parton played that role. What's it like to play this part?
It's awesome.
She had a lot of good lines.
Yes, she did. Yeah, you know, yeah. Learning to do the Southern accent and letting everyone know that there's no such thing as a natural beauty is really fun.
So many good lines in this. My favorite one is when Clary tells Weezer that she has the handwriting of a serial killer. I love that.
Yes.
But everybody gets great lines and great
Absolutely.
Moments. All six characters.
Yes.
Yeah, right? And
yes,
what's it like to direct these six leads?
It's amazing. This has been an amazing experience. I'm just seeing the evolution of the actors from the first time that we began rehearsal till now, where they've truly embrace these characters and have just breathed life into them. So it's been awesome.
And is this being done with an all African-American cast?
No,
it's
actually
a diverse cast.
It's a diverse cast.
Yes.
So that adds that's a nice twist to it as well. And
yes.
More reflective of the South in general, right?
Absolutely.
Especially as it is now.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you incorporate that into this production?
I believe that just what everyone brought to the table, just from their backgrounds and their connections to the movie Steel Magnolias, I think just that is what brought on the richer chemistry.
Right. And in fact, it's more about their connection, their friendship, than it is about anything else. In fact, their race never even
comes
up.
Doesn't even come into it. And yeah, what it's really about is just this celebration of friendship among
exactly.
women.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so as a female director, how do you try to honor that?
I think what I do is to encourage them to get connected off the stage. And I think once that started to come into play, where we would have moments where we would just sit and talk and hearing stories that were relative to all the women, it shows up on stage.
And it's Mother's Day weekend. So
yes.
What better gift for mom
yes.
than to take her to see this,
yes.
right?
It's very appropriate.
right. And it's this weekend only. So people need to act now.
Absolutely. Yes. It opens tonight.
Opens tonight.
Yes.
And it runs through Sunday.
Yes.
So take mom to see Steel Magnolias this weekend. You'll love it. Sons and daughters both. This is a great idea for your mom. If you've never been to a production at Stage Aurora at Gateway, make this the first time. The classic Broadway film, Steel Magnolias, on stage now tonight through Sunday at Stage Aurora. stageaurora.org for tickets. And break a leg. Thank you so much, both of you, for giving us a preview.
Thank you
so
much.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
She's director Chantel Bennett-Johnson and starring as Truvy Effie Durbin. Again, Steel Magnolias this Mother's Day weekend. Tickets at stageaurora.org. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, just drop an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. Never miss a show. Just download the First Coast Connect podcast on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.